Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Joule, the immersion circulator for sous vide by Chef Steps. Order now at chefsteps.com/joule. Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday from pretty late this time, but actually we're only doing a half-hour show, I think, this time, but from roughly 12 to, you know, roughly 12:45, 12:55, Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Joined, as usual, with Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. How you doing, Nastasia?
Good.
Yeah, we got Dave in the booth. How you doing, Dave?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Doing all right. Oh, we just got some birch syrup in from Zan. It says, hey, Cooking Issues, greetings from Alaska. Here is some birch syrup from my hometown. Enjoy. And then I guess they're from Homer because it says Homer couple taps tree. So I assume that's Homer, Alaska, yeah?
Yeah.
Now, the only birch syrup I've ever had before was, and I think I mentioned this on the air, which is maybe why Zan sent it to us, the only birch syrup I've had before was flawed. And by flawed, I mean like extremely acidic, as though something, either the sap was extremely high acid or something had grown in it. And I didn't know whether that's just the way, what you hear crinkling in the background is not mouth noises. Please don't be afraid, Cooking Issues people. It's Nastasia unwrapping the birch syrup. It's wrapped in bubble wrap and aluminum foil to prevent the alien rays from getting to it. One thing I have to say, Zan, it takes a lot of guts to wrap stuff in aluminum foil because you never know. Some lunatic might be like, I can't see through it with my machine, so I'm going to open it up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Did I ever tell you about the time I ordered that espresso machine and they didn't drain the boiler and they had originally packed it okay, but then when they shipped it to me, a little water had dripped out, so UPS completely unpacked it, and when they packed it, they were like, ah, it's wet, ah, and they threw the entire thing back in the box without the packing, and then rattled it around over and over and over again, and when they showed it up, every single panel was shattered and broken.
Geez.
I got that espresso machine basically for free, and I'm still using it to this day. Ooh, this looks nice. Take a little taste here. Mmm, that's good. It is actually tart, but this one is not flawed. So birch syrup must be inherently tarter than, what's it called? Maple. But I think this is delicious. This is a much superior product to the one that I tried before. You get to dip your finger in that? It's pure syrup, Stas. She's
well,
drinking
it's not
it.
Come in my mouth anyway.
I'm not going to go there.
I know.
I'm not going to go there. So what do you think?
Tart.
What do you think, though? The taste?
It's good. I like it.
I think it's delicious. Mm-hmm. And it looks to be about, I have to test it, it looks to be about 66 bricks. And the company, for those of you that are keeping track of such things, is Bridge Creek Birch Syrup. 100% pure birch syrup made in Homer, Alaska. Well, thanks so much. I always love doing a taste test. Tomorrow I fly out to Portland to have some truffles, so more on that next week when I'm back. Anything good going on, Nastasia?
No. Nothing good.
Have we talked about the House Guest Olympics?
No.
All right. This is something I think that this is something that Jen and I did back when we were in our early 20s. But I think it's just as valid now. And I meant to talk to Nastasia about this. It's super valid for you, especially for Nastasia, because she has so many poor house guests. But Jen and I used to – we always wonder when people come over – like, who raised you? You know what I mean? Like, where did you come from? Like, how did you show up at my house completely empty-handed, make a huge mess, and then just hightail it out and, like, leave me with all this garbage, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Dave, you have this problem? Do you invite people over to your house?
Yeah, but I've never really been stiffed like that. Not that I can recall.
Oh, you have good house. So here's what you do. There's dinner, but there's also people who come and stay at your place. And so what we did is we started kind of the House Guest Olympics, and we would rank people when they came over. And we didn't tell people that we were ranking them. Maybe a little bit we did. But it's like we were like ranking people, and we really got a sense for kind of who people were with this kind of a House Guest Olympics. Like the person who clearly wins the House Guest Olympics is my cousin Nathan, who whenever he shows up, Nathan, he shows up with stuff. The guy doesn't like dessert, So, like, at the end of dinner, when everyone's eating dessert, he's in the dish, like, area, cleaning all of the dishes. And so he shows up, brings you stuff, has good conversation, doesn't talk about stuff that pisses everybody off. Like, we'll talk. You know how when you have that one person?
Not like cooking issues.
You know how that one person, there's always that one person that you invite who doesn't say anything, and you're like, oh, my God, who's going to talk to that one person who doesn't say anything? You know who that guy is? Nathan. Nathan's that guy that will go talk to that person at your house. Mm-hmm. And not make it awkward that there's that person in the corner that's mm-hmm. just basically, you know, capillary action, sucking all of your wine, even out of the bottles. You don't even know where it's going, but they're in the corner, like, sucking up all the wine and not saying anything to anyone. Nathan's the guy that'll talk to them and mm-hmm. clean your dishes. So that is, like, that's, like, gold medal, like, 10.0 floor routine, like, house guest Olympics. But I recommend to all you people out there that you start keeping track of the house guest Olympics, and then if you let people know, maybe people get better. Doesn't that sound nice, Nastassja? Mm-hmm. You should rate all your friends. Would they all fail?
No, they're not as bad as you think.
What is that? Like, if they're not as bad as I think, that means they're not as bad as you tell me they are.
They were also a lot younger back 8 years ago when I met you. So
yeah, but no, but it's like Nastassja. She says stuff. Like, they're not as bad as you think. The only thing I know about them is what Nastassja tells me.
They were bad 8 years ago.
Uh-huh. So you're saying they've graduated?
Yes.
No offense to the Yellowtail Corporation, but they've graduated beyond.
Yes. Yes.
They no longer come over to your house and say, I'm not bringing any wine because I'm not drinking today. And then they drink wine anyway.
That hasn't happened in a while. Many years.
Like 2 weeks?
No.
All right. Anyway, House Guest Olympics. So we have some questions in. Vincent wrote in from Michigan regarding salting. We didn't deal with any. The only thing we dealt with was rabbits, right?
Yeah. Right.
Right. Okay. I only recently found out about cooking issues and been listening through the back catalog. I'm only at episode 120, but everything's been good. By the way, what episode are we on now?
I have no idea.
Dave, what episode is this?
Let me check the archives one sec.
First, I would like to thank you for opening my eyes to the wonder that is the music of Daryl Hall and John Oates. That's straight out to you, Nastassja. Although you went to go see them in concert.
Bad.
Well, bad for what reason? Were they actually bad, or they disappointed you because he kept on trying to be younger and hitting on the women?
And what's it called? Jamming.
Oh, you hate jamming?
Yeah.
You hate all forms of jamming?
No, I mean, they're not a jam band.
As far as you know, is that the first time you ever saw them live?
Yeah.
But how do you know that they're not a jam band?
Well, don't jam bands, like, if a jam band's a jam band, it's played like that on the radio, right?
No, I mean, they don't usually, jam bands don't usually get played on the radio.
Well, like
ever.
The Allman Brothers.
Wait, is the question whether Hall & Oates is a jam band?
The question is why would you assume that Hall... I mean, I would assume that they're not because they're like 80s, just like, you know, 80s. Like, I assume that they only come out of like boombox stereo speakers.
Right.
That's what I assume that they come out of. But, I mean, like... No, I mean, like, people... what you hear from the Allman Brothers is like Rambling Man. That song's only 2 minutes and 35
or
seconds.
Grateful Dead.
Grateful Dead is not played on the radio.
Yes, it is.
What radio plays the Grateful Dead? They didn't when I was a kid.
Yeah, they play them.
Like what?
They play like the shorter rock songs, like Touch of Grey or whatever.
No, Touch of Grey was like their least... Yeah, that's the least Grateful Dead song on earth, Touch of Grey. That was like after like they had already done anything they were going to do. You ever hear like... You never hear like Casey Jones on the radio,
yeah,
do you?
Yeah, you do.
What radio? Not when
you
I was growing up.
You don't listen to the radio.
I did back when I was younger.
You don't listen to the radio now.
Not now.
Right.
No offense, radio people. But the point is that when I was growing up...
What's wrong with radio?
When I was growing up, nothing. When I was growing up, when the Grateful Dead was actually playing, you know what I mean? And not just, like, doing, like, you know, reunions when they're all, like, half of them are dead. Back when they were actually a band and no one had died yet, miraculously, that stuff was not on the radio at all. You know what I mean? But anyway, I don't know. Do they play Fish on the radio?
Not that I know of.
Not the stations I listen to.
Dave Matthews?
Yes, they play him. That's a jam band.
So. Right, do they play long, like, 20-minute songs on the radio?
20-minute songs? No, I don't think anybody plays 20-minute songs.
Radio.
10-minute.
On the radio?
Yes.
On regular radio?
Yes.
On radio that these people out here eating pizza would listen to?
I don't think hipsters listen to AM, FM radio. Hmm.
They should. They should listen to AM only, but only in mono.
Right.
This is taking a weird turn.
Yeah. Anyway. All right. Vincent.
What was the actual question?
Oh, no, he just mentioned Hall & Oates, and so we're talking about music and Hall & Oates. By the way...
Oh, we've only gone through the preamble of the question.
Little story, yeah, little story. Nastasia Lopez, this is a classic Nastasia, by the way, once bought tickets to see Billy Joel at one of his Madison Square Garden performances. And as anyone who knows us personally knows, both fans of Billy Joel. We like Billy Joel. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up close enough to Long Island. I don't know where Nastasia got her love of Billy Joel, but, like, you know, I love myself some Billy Joel.
Mm-hmm.
Nastasia buys herself tickets. Dave, you'll like this. Ticket. To go alone. So Nastasia buys a ticket, and then...
That's so adorable.
Then we're at an event together, literally working an event. And by the way, it was a garbage event. I don't even remember what it was. And she goes, oh my God, I'm supposed to be at Billy Joel. I just missed a Billy Joel concert. First of all, I didn't need her to be at the event. She could have gone to the Billy Joel concert. She knows it. She doesn't blame me for this. She just forgot she had the concert. Mm-hmm. But here's the kicker, Dave. This is pure Nastasia Lopez. Nastasia... will never buy again a Billy Joel ticket, even though she desperately wants to go, but she's going to punish herself because, no, I already bought that ticket, and I didn't get to see it. So now she's never going to allow herself to see Billy Joel again. What reminds me is Billy Joel, a friend of mine, Lucia and Guido, went to go see him last week at the Garden, said he did some jams, but said he was great, still good. So maybe someday... Someday I'll buy you a ticket, or maybe some like Cooking Issues admirer will send you a Billy Joel ticket to the...
I don't want anybody to pay for it.
But Nastasia, the only way you get to go see Billy Joel in concert is someone pays for you.
An extra ticket.
Who the hell has an extra ticket?
Lots of people.
Whatever. I don't know how we got it. Oh, another thing. Did you know that Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Circus is closing? Mm-hmm. Do you know that nobody cares but me? Nobody cares but
me. My sister felt sad.
Is she going to go?
I don't think so.
I might go to... It's at Barclays Center in, like, February, March. I need to find someone who cares to go with me.
When's the last time you went to the circus? That's one of those things that you just forget even exists anymore. And now I guess it doesn't.
When Booker was very small, I took him. But my grandparents lived in right near Sarasota, so they took me to see them during their practice when they weren't on the road, because that's where both troops would train. Like, they used to, you know, they were like a railroad-only show for a long time. So in New York, they used to march all of their animals from the railroad depot in Brooklyn, or Queens maybe, through the Midtown Tunnel. And then they would walk from the Midtown Tunnel over to the Garden where it was going on. And so you could go in the middle of the night and watch the entire circus parade all of the animals through the tunnel and out. It was nutty, like miniature horses. Good business. Anyway, end of an era.
We should get to the question. Running out of time.
Okay. So here are the questions they have. I read this article, and it's from Food and Wine, written by Oliver Schwanner Albright years ago, like 4 or 5 years ago, where the authors you can find it on the internet. It's called "The Juicy Secret to Seasoning Meat," where the authors' experiment resulted in the conclusion that different meats or cooking methods require different timings for salting the meat for best results. Does this match your experience and knowledge? Is there any sort of best practice guideline for which kinds of meat or which cooking methods should have salt applied at certain times? And then second question was, I had once read that Dongpo pork belly where the – I once had red cooked Dongpo pork belly where the fat was so soft and tender that it had almost the texture of creme caramel. How can I achieve this? Keep up the good work, Cooking Issues team. All right. So let's go in reverse order. For the pork belly, it's been a long time since I've made that. But if it's not – soft, I think you have two things. Most people who do it, right, they do like a lot of kind of scraping of the skin beforehand, and some people will even needle it, and this lets like some stuff kind of come out of it, and then they do your initial, typically a blanch step, and then after the blanch step, then comes the first, which is kind of a braise slash steam over a bed of like scallions and ginger with the rock sugar and the red and the dark and the light soy sauce, right? And then after that, so the crappy recipes, which probably aren't as good, just do that until the kind of the meat is done. The good recipes then take it out of that, put it in an individual steamer, and then steam the bejesus out of it with some of the juice, but so that it's no longer evaporating anymore. And they do that until fundamentally the fat is totally kind of broken down. And, you know, everyone has their own recipe, whether they do it skin side up or skin side down. Most people I know... do it skin side down, then flip it skin side up. Although I saw a place that did it that flipped it three times, right? So I think a lot of it just has to do with that secondary steam step. I don't know how important the initial scraping or needling of it is, but that's a good product. Do you like pork belly when the skin is not crunchy, Stas, or do you only like it when the skin's crunchy?
When it's crunchy.
Unless it's like in a steamed bun or something like this.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't like just a big chunk of red pork?
Mm-mm.
I do. I love that stuff. Dave, you like the gooey pork belly fat, or do you like it only when the skin's been crispified?
Yeah, I guess to paraphrase Hall & Oates, I could go for that.
You could go for that?
Yeah, why not?
They said no can do.
That's why I said paraphrase.
Well, it's more like antiphrase. Nastassi is more paraphrasing. She's like, no can do.
There was a steel drum player playing that song on the 59th Street song.
Oh, hate steel drums.
Yeah, I did too.
Whoa. Why do you hate steel drums? Is it because you hate Caribbean people? Or like...
that's quite a leap, but no.
Why do you hate steel drums?
I don't know. They just annoy me.
Yep.
What about when they have two different steel drums and they can play two different notes at once?
Don't care.
Ooh.
What about the fact that they make their own instruments? That's pretty baller.
I guess that's cool.
I tried to make one once when I was a kid. You know what I was? Unsuccessful. Like, I was able to...
Did you cut yourself?
Did I cut myself? I don't remember. I was very young, although I remember this. If you're going to try to make your own steel drum, the most important thing is you have to be able to take the 55-gallon drum and then, like, kind of depress it out, right? And that's kind of what I didn't do. I didn't have enough heat to really be able to bend that whole kind of drum thing out. But I spent the whole dang day doing it. And I just remember being really disappointed because as like, you know, an 11-year-old, I was like, man, steel drums are cool. But apparently you guys were like, steel drums are for jerks and...
Not cool, man.
Not cool. I don't know. I don't know what the Cooking Issues crowd thinks of the steel drums.
Chat room, any thoughts?
I don't know.
All right, we'll see.
So to go back to the question of salting. Salting is both much easier and much more complicated than you'd think. Salting does a number of things. Salting obviously makes things taste better, right? So salt in general is good. When you're talking about salting meats before or after or during, what you really want to do is focus on what you're attempting to do with the meat. So a long time before where the salt actually gets to penetrate into the interior of the meat, right? For a meat that's going to be overcooked anyway, when I say overcooked, I mean cooked above rare or medium rare, then in general, the salt is going to allow the meat to hold on to more water, right? So you're not only going to season it, but you're going to allow the meat to hold on to more water. It has more water absorption. However, it also has a kind of firmer texture once it's been salted than it would otherwise. And this is due to a number of reasons. One, and I don't think it's primarily dehydration. I think it's primarily because you're solubilizing some proteins that come out and form a gel with it. So it kind of firms up. So salting firms the meat. And you can think about this very clearly if you think about when you salt a fish and you let it sit for a long time, the flesh gets a good bit firmer. The same thing happens when you're doing pork or a steak or something like this. And so when I'm going to eat something that is rare or medium rare, and I'm going to let it sit for a long time, right, then I don't want to salt it more than about an hour or two before it's going to get eaten because I don't want the interior of that meat to firm up on me. This is specifically with kind of low temperature cooking. If you're going to do it on the grill, right, then you can just undercook the inside a little bit more and you could salt it way beforehand. It's probably not going to affect it too much. It'll be a little firmer, but it's not going to be a big deal. But once you cook the entire piece of meat up to, let's say, 55 and a half, it's not that it's overcooked if you salt it a long time before, but it's just a little bit firmer and it has a little bit less of that kind of steak texture that rare, medium rare has where it starts, you know what I'm talking about, where it goes from that point of being kind of like where it still kind of moves independently. It feels kind of like, you know, like the way Cesare cooks it. It still feels mm-hmm. like meat, and then it goes all of a sudden to being that cooked meat where it's like one piece now. Mm-hmm. It doesn't kind of move independently. And it's that firming that happens when you salt far in advance on pieces of meat that you want to have that texture on. And so those are the only real things that I take into account. So that's, you know, that's kind of the big that's kind of the big difference. So what happened is that person, the one that they hated the most, is they pre-salted the heck out. I think it's been 2 weeks since I read it, but they pre-salted the heck out of a pork loin, which is already kind of garbage. It's a good piece of meat, but it's typically overcooked. And then they went ahead and overcooked it, and so they salted it. They salted it all the way through. Now it's already firm, and so it's going to tend to be dry. I can't remember exactly how. The pork loin was the one that they had the difference in. Just think about it this. If you're going to overcook it, then salting it, in my mind, is usually good, the way to go, because it's going to hold on to more water. If you and it's going to get textures. If you need it to taste more rare and unadulterated, like pure steak, and you're going to cook it for hours and hours, low temp, then salt right before you're going to sear it or something like this. But that's basically what I do. Anyway, anyone who disagrees with me, they're welcome to get on and disagree with me.
Hey, before you go, you want to take a call?
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave. This is Chris from Green Zone in D.C. How you doing?
Doing all right. What's going on?
Got a question. I have been using your milk washing technique for coffee-infused booze from Liquid Intelligence for a while, and it's always worked pretty well, except this last time, last night, I did it exactly as always, as written in the book, and the liquid basically didn't clarify. And so I'm trying to filter the booze out of the milk curds, and I've gone through like 3 coffee filters, and it's a giant pain in the butt. And I'm wondering what could have happened.
Same recipe?
Yeah, exact same.
Same milk?
Yeah, same type of milk. I mean, I'm using full like whole milk, but it might have been a different brand.
The only times I've had it really fail on me was I've used ultra pasteurized milk. In fact, it was and there might be a range, right? So I'll give you an example. So like I normally use regular pasteurized whole milk. But when I went to Spain last time, they got me that wretched kind of boxed Parmalat milk, which is like ultra high, like sterilized milk. And
right.
It did not work at all. So maybe there's some in-between zone in the ultra-pasteurizing zone where it doesn't work. Where it partially works, you know what I mean?
This says pasteurized. It doesn't say ultra-pasteurized, but it also says non-homogenized. So I don't know if that makes a difference. Would it?
Huh. That's interesting. I've never tried it with non-homogenized milk before. I'd be interested to try it with non-homogenized milk. But you say it did form a curd, but it just didn't curd very well?
It's no opposite actually happened. The curds were much chunkier than usual.
Huh. But it didn't fill.
There was a lot of, like, normally when I do it, it forms the curds and then I put it in the fridge overnight and there's a clear layer of booze on top. The booze was cloudy.
Oh, so there was a curd layer, but the booze layer was still cloudy?
Yeah.
I wonder whether it's some sort of like, excess fat in it from it not being homogenized?
Could be.
Huh. I don't know. I'll have to test it with some non-homogenized milk and see what's going on. But it could be that something about the fat not coming. Did it still function well? Just didn't look right? Did it seem fattier?
I've always filtered it through a coffee filter. And it usually, it can, you know, filters out pretty quickly. But this time I've gone through 3 coffee filters and it's still not done.
Huh. I hate coffee filters so much. I wish I could throw it into a centrifuge.
Yeah, I funded the Spinzol, so I hope it gets into production.
Oh, me too. We're working on it. We'll have some more announcements in the next couple of weeks, right, Stas?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, you know, I think it's looking better. I think it's looking good. I think we're going to make it happen. What do you think, Nastasia?
I hope so.
Yeah. Cool. But yeah, it makes milk.
So when you do it, do you use whole milk, you said?
I use whole milk, but I use whole, like, supermarket, like, regular supermarket milk, like, so
okay.
Homogenized, pasteurized milk. I know it doesn't work with Parmalat, and maybe it doesn't work as well with without centrifuge. With non-homogenized, but it's something to check. And I'd be interested in throwing it into a fuge to see whether it would spin out.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine it would, but all right. Well, I guess next time I'll just try the regular homogenized stuff then.
Cool. All righty. Let me know.
All right, man. Thanks.
All right, cool. Nate Simon wrote in from Sacramento.
Dave,
what?
Do you need to get to your event? Or?
Yeah. But let me just do a couple more. I'll, Start late and end late.
We got a show at one.
Well, I won't start. Okay. I won't end late, but I mean like, you know, later than I need.
All right.
I'm a big fan of cooking vegetables. This is from Simon, Nate Simon in Sacramento. What do you think of Sactown, Stacia?
Fine.
She's like, I don't care about Sacramento. Just speed it up. That's the hand motion that you can't see that she's making. Now you made me lose my place, see? I'm a big fan of cooking vegetables in the pressure cooker, which I then puree for soups. I do like the ability of the pressure cooker to caramelize the vegetables. However, most recipes recommend adding a small amount of baking soda to facilitate the Maillard reaction. Remember, though, you got to keep straight the difference between caramelization, which is a sugar-only thing, and Maillard, which is reducing sugar and proteins. And we often say caramelized when we actually mean Maillard, but like something like a carrot actually also has enough sugar in it that at higher temperatures anyway, actual caramelization can take place. And sugars, in fact, can caramelize on their own in a pressure cooker under the right circumstances, i.e. with baking soda. So in a pressure cooker with a high sugar item, there is actually both Maillard reactions and caramelization reactions going on in a basic environment, i.e. alkaline environment, but just something to keep track of. I find that even with small amounts of baking soda, less than 0.5%, I can still taste it. I call it the pretzel taste. I'm wondering if the baking soda is absolutely necessary. Could the vegetables just be cooked for a longer period of time and get the same degree of caramelization? Well, again, the question is it caramelization or is it Maillard? Is there any other alkalizing agent that can be used that doesn't give that funny side taste? Thanks and best wishes, Nate Simon. I don't know. I haven't run a lot of the tests. You could just try to cook it longer, but longer might mean like twice as long, and see kind of what happens. It's possible also that if you were to allow more liquid to evaporate off, then the temperature would go kind of even higher, but you'd run into some problems with scorching at that point, unless you were doing the kind of trivet and jar technique. I've done some like ultra high temperature ones where I have pre-reduced, gotten some, you know, liquid out and then put them in oil in it, but it's not really safe. I wouldn't really recommend doing it, and I can get like much higher temperatures that way. Lastly, I want to make sure that you should just try it and see whether you like the result. Just do it for twice as long and see what happens. But I would also say I don't know whether the recipes that you're using have you neutralized the baking soda a little bit. Unfortunately, baking soda doesn't neutralize to salt and water the way that like hydrochloric acid and lye would do. It does. It neutralizes to sodium acetate, which has a little bit of a vinegar. If you use acetic acid, then it will go to sodium acetate. Right? Yes, it'll go to sodium acetate. And then that's what they use for salt and vinegar potato chips. So if you want a little bit of a vinegar taste to it, you could try to neutralize it with a little bit of vinegar. You could try to use a tiny pinch of food grade sodium hydroxide, but I wouldn't use HCl for it. So you're still going to have an acetate ion in there when you neutralize it. But I would just be careful. As everyone knows, lye in the kitchen can be dangerous if you don't label your core containers and you taste it like a jerk. Lastly, Zach writes in about low temperature meats. My wife's family routinely commits war crime level overcooking of any meat. As a result, I'm increasingly volunteer to host or bring entrees to family events. This has led to a secondary problem. They won't eat anything that is even pink inside, poultry, pork, and even beef. I can't bring myself to intentionally overcook, and I think they would actually like to eat things that are cooked much less if they could get past the psychological barrier. So is there a way with low temp cooking to greatly reduce the amount of redness in a cooked piece of meat without actually cooking it more, i.e. could I enzymatically degrade the hemoglobin? It's not hemoglobin, by the way, it's myoglobin, or otherwise catalyze its degradation at a lower temperature. The second point you have you ever noticed that when toasting almonds, that if you taste them while they're still hot, their texture is odd and off-putting, and flavor even seems to be off? I think that's more of a texture issue, but it could be a flavor thing because of the volatiles coming out of them, especially if you leave the skins on. But once they cool, they get that great crunchiness and texture. What's going on there? I think what's going on there is the protein, it's like a protein gel, and when it's hot, it with any residual moisture, it's just a little bit rubbery, and then when it cools down, it gets all nice and solid. Remember, roasting, you're actually flashing off almost all the water. So it's, I think it's basically just that, that protein gel. Back to your meats. The problem with meats is that when you vacuum pack or cook something low temperature in a bag or anything like this, a lot of the myoglobin is in its deoxygenated state, deoxymyoglobin. Deoxymyoglobin is much more resistant to heat denaturation than regular oxymyoglobin is. So what happens is that you have a lot of deoxy left. It cooks. Then when you get it out of the bag, it kind of blooms and gets red. Also, in poultry, you have actual hemoglobin there coming out of the bones, especially in younger meat. So with poultry, get rid of all the bones, trim out those areas, cook it faster. It's been my experience that the faster rates of cooking, so in other words, thinner pieces of meat, faster rates of cooking are going to get better coloration, well, more cooked-looking coloration for you. But allow it to bloom up in a full oxygen environment. Even allow it to go, if you were to do things that make it look terrible beforehand, like form metmyoglobin, i.e. put it in a micro-oxygen environment so that it oxidizes, pull it out, and then like expose it to large amounts of oxygen, oxygenated meat will turn brown very quickly. And so I'm actually experimenting with the low-temperature book that I'm doing, different ways to get around this problem since it is a problem. And so as I do experiments, I'll let you guys know. I'll give you more feedback on how to make meats look overcooked even when they're not cooking issues.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.